John chapter 13. Sermon out of John chapter 4 and talking about Jesus' encounter with the Samaritan woman at the well, and talked about what happened in her life and in the lives of the people around her when she realized that she was fully known and fully loved by God. And we talked about the fact that we're all wired in the same way, that in the core of our souls we want to be fully known and fully loved. And the good news is that that is true of us in God's view of us. Last week, we looked in John chapter 1 about Jesus' encounter with a skeptical man named Nathaniel, and looked at what happened and the fact that he came to faith. He believed when he discovered that Jesus knew him before they met. But then Jesus also gave him an identity. He said, "You are a true Israelite in whom there's nothing false." And he refers to this well-known story about Jacob. But from that, and gave him the identity as, like Jacob, as one who wrestles with God. And so even though he came to Jesus skeptical and doubting, he came away with his faith going to a deeper level, and it all began with Jesus telling him who he was. And so we've looked at two aspects of known that we're going to be focusing on this year. Security, who we're known by, and identity, who we're known as. Today, we're going to focus on legacy, which has to do with what we're known for. When my daughter Julia was young, she liked to help me work on stuff. And that's not so much true anymore. But she liked to help when I was fixing something. And I like to have her around because she applauds. You know, you don't usually get that when you just fix something around the house. But with Julia, you know, the light is fixed. You know, change a light bulb. "Daddy, you're awesome." You know. "Thank you, thank you. It was really nothing. I'd like to thank my dad, who taught me how to change a light bulb. He taught me everything I know about interior illumination." When she was about 5 years old, she was on a trip with me to Home Depot, and we were talking, and she said, "Why do you have so many tools?" And I said, "Because I got so many things that need fixing." And she said, "Can you be a builder?" And I had to explain to her, you know, I can fix things and I stay at it. And my perfectionism kind of helps with that. But I'd be way too slow to make a living at it. And so I don't think I can be a builder. She said, "Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And she said, "And I don't, and you can't say daddy because you're already a daddy. I'm talking about like a builder or a doctor or a painter or an artist." And she said, "A painter or an artist or a king." And that struck a chord with me, you know. But she said, "I want to be a queen when I grow up." And then she said, "I want to be a queen who enjoys television and playing in her room." You know, it's good to have clear goals and a clear vision of what you want to be. She wanted to be a queen who enjoys television and playing in her room. But, you know, it didn't stop there. That was the spring of 2007 when she was five. She started first grade that fall. And at the beginning of the year, teachers always give you these kind of get-to-know-me activities. And one of them was fill in the blank. And it says, when I grow up, I want to be, and Julia put, a queen. And I was thinking about that, and that would require some fairly remarkable changes. Especially if she decides to stay here. It's like Queen of Atlanta? Queen of Gwinnett? I don't know. That, you know, would require a complete restructuring of our whole system of government and that kind of thing. A radical change in the way that we think about life, other people. Everything would have to change in order for Julia to be queen here. You know, we don't usually think in terms of things changing that radically. But I think maybe there's some ways that we should think like that more often. In John chapter 13, this is Jesus' last night with his disciples before he's arrested and then goes ultimately to the cross and the tomb and the resurrection. But he's with the disciples for the last time. And at the beginning of John 13, it says, because Jesus loved you. I'll just read that. It was just before the Passover feast, verse 1. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from him and was returning to him. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped his towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. But Jesus, as difficult as this time was, he goes on later in this chapter to say, one of you is going to betray me. But Jesus was so solid in his identity. He said he knew that God had put all things under his feet, and he knew where he was where he had come from, and he knew where he was going. Jesus knew where he came from, and he knew where he's going. So what did he do? He got up, wrapped a towel around his waist, and he washed their feet. Look down at verse 31. Right before this, Jesus sort of dismisses Judas. It says, when he was gone, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself, and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Simon Peter asked him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus replied, where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later. Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Then Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. But do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going. In this scene, as Jesus gets up, he takes off his outer garment, he wraps the towel around his waist, and he goes and he starts washing their feet. And I don't know how you read this, but when I read through that, it's like you can almost feel feel the squirming in the room. It seems awkward to me. And it wasn't just that Jesus, their Lord and Master, was making himself subservient to them. It was like in this moment when Jesus had so much ahead of him that the disciples would actually begin to get an inkling of in this very setting. You know, beyond that, it was just this almost painful intimacy. Here's Jesus, the Son of God, undressed, towel wrapped around him, washing their feet, touching them tenderly, compassionately, where they were the dirtiest, touching them where they needed it the most. Including Jesus' betrayer, Judas, who's sitting there with perfectly washed and dried feet. Then Judas leaves, and Jesus starts talking about glory, his glory. Judas is going to betray him. He's going to set events in motion that can't be stopped. He's going to set events in motion that Jesus didn't even try to stop. He said, go ahead and do what you need to do. And right in the middle of that, he talks about glory. And also right in the middle of that, he talks about, in verse 34, a new command I give you, love each other. Now the command to love each other had been around centuries. But he said, here's the new part. What you've seen in me, that kind of love, that's the love that you have for each other. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. In fact, he says, this will be one of your primary identities to the people around you. This will become your legacy. This is what you will be known for. When people look at you and see that you love each other in the way that I've loved you, people are going to take note and say, these men have been with Jesus. These men love the way Jesus did. By this, all people will know that you're my disciples. This will become what you're known for. This is your legacy. And he said, you know, love the way that I love. What did he mean by that? What might that look like? Well, I think you can read all the Gospels and get a full picture of that, but right then, in this context, the way Jesus demonstrated it, in fact, what John says is, in verse 1, he says, having loved those who were his own, he now showed them the full extent of his love. He now showed them how far he was willing to go. He laid down his life for them. He served them. He met their needs. He met them where they were. And addressed their greatest needs. You know, that kind of work is rarely glamorous. It's just needed. You know, in Luke 22 and also in Matthew 23, Jesus said, the greatest among you will be your servant. You know, and I don't think Jesus was throwing this out there as a challenge. To say, listen, are you guys willing to serve? You got to step up and show me you're committed. You got to prove your devotion to me by humbling yourself and becoming servants. I think it was challenging to love. It is challenging to love like Jesus loved. I think Jesus said it because it's simply true. the greatest people that we know are the ones who serve. The people who mean the most to us. Let me ask you, who are the people in your life that mean the most to you? You're probably like me. I remember people who cared for me, served me. You know, when I was sick or sad or lost or hungry or just needed a friend. People who were willing to be there. People who loved me. You know, I'm looking forward. I'm really looking forward to the Winter Olympics that are about to start here in a few days. Any Winter Olympic fans out there? Yeah, curling, stuff like that. You know, I like ski jumping, and I like to imagine that I would have done that one time if I had the opportunity. Would have. It's just, these people fly. They fly off of a mountain on purpose. It's amazing, but you know what? I can't tell you who won the gold medal in ski jumping 4 years ago. Any like hardcore ski jumping fans in here who know who won the gold medal? Okay. Accomplishment, impressiveness is not what makes the greatest among us. The greatest people in our lives, the greatest people in our community are the ones who lay themselves down for other people, who lay their lives down, who serve, who care, who see us. And they're willing to do the unglamorous, needful things. We all have needs. And if there are people who are willing to put themselves aside and serve us, they're the people who change our lives. Such incredible examples of servants in this church. I talk about it all the time, and I'm going to keep talking about it. It takes about 100 volunteers every week to make this happen. And you do it, and you just keep doing it. You know, I don't know if you noticed it on the scrolling thing, we try to provide enough distractions for the scrolling announcements for people who, you're going to be distracted by something anyway. So it might as well be information that you need. But there's a thing up there that says we need some more ushers. And this is what I feel about this church. It's like when we say here's a need, it's just going to get met. Because that's who you are. You know, I think about it's what you're known for. You're known for serving. When you think about legacy and what we're known for, I think that all of us as parents, there's nothing nearer and dearer to our hearts than our children. And there's a big sense in that our children and their children and their children are our legacy. They're a big part of it. They're not all of it. But our children are just, they're a part of us. They are from us. You know, my story includes being the father of Alex and Austin. My story includes this amazing trip in 2003 to China to adopt Julia. This is a part that's true, but also a little difficult in some ways, is that really our legacy and what we're known for, we're not going to see the whole thing. But really, what we're known for is not something you do by accident. What you become known for is something that you do devote yourself to. It's not something you do by accident. It's not something you just do every once in a while, or maybe if you get around to it. The things you're known for are things that become a part of who you are. That's why you're known for service. It's not because it happens every once in a while. It happens all the time in many, many ways that nobody knows about. Sometimes I find about how you're serving each other by accident. But becoming the kind of people who become the greatest through service doesn't happen by accident. It's an intentional choice. To say, I choose to love the way Jesus loved, which means out of this overflowing gratitude for the way that Jesus laid down his life for me, I now choose to lay down my life for other people. I believe legacy, these things that we do, what we become known for, they flow from our identity. If somebody says, you know what, I am a follower of Jesus Christ, I want to walk in his footsteps, then I, because that's my identity, then I want to do the things that Jesus said to do, and then the things we do become what we're known for. It begins with us being known by God. Us being known, fully known and fully loved before we were even aware of it. God loved us first. And then contact was made. We got the picture, and then God gives us an identity. And then as we live into that identity, we develop a legacy, what we're known for. You know, I want to encourage all the parents to of student ministry, middle school and high school, to be a part of these kickoffs that Josh announced. I think there's a special bond that I have with a set of parents, and that we've raised our kids together, and we still are raising our kids together. But especially through middle school and high school, we would meet on a regular basis at these SNL meetings and the kickoffs, and we were just together on a regular basis. It's good. I mean, outside of the content of what we talk about, I mean, it's helpful to know what our kids are studying in their small groups and in the devotionals they do. It really is helpful. But beyond any of that content, just to sit together, to be together, to talk and to laugh and to share stories and share struggles and share victories and to have an identity as we are a group of parents that are raising our kids together. And I heard somebody say years ago that, you know, that's a great definition of fellowship is just two fellows in the same ship. You know, we're in the same boat here. We have many of the same joys, these ecstatic moments of, oh, I can't believe it's this good, and some of our deepest fears and concerns and worries. And some of the same dreams for our children. It's just good to be together. That identity. To talk about our needs. To be able to serve each other as a group of people that are doing what's more important than anything else to us. What our legacy becomes, what we become known for, happens intentionally. It's not by accident. It does come through devotion. You know, legacy is not something you dabble in. It's not something you do for a couple hours on Sunday. It's something you're devoted to. Legacy is about what you practice. It's what becomes embedded in your character. And really, character is just essentially behavior over time. One of the amazing parts about the good news is that Jesus says, by following me, by looking at me, by modeling your life after me, I can teach you how to become good people. I can teach you how to live into the life that you were created for. And one of the very core things that's there is learning to love the way that Jesus loved. But it takes devotion. You know, when you think about legacy, the question of legacy is really asking you, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be known for? You know, that's a good question to think about from time to time. What do I want to be known for? I've been thinking recently about this question, about what I want to be known for. And part of it is that I'm 53 and I've recently had to go, you know, get a physical. And so you start thinking about your body and how it's not what it used to be and stuff like that. And you start thinking about, you know, this thing's not going to last forever. And, you know, and that's just normal. But we want our lives to count. We're going to be known for something. We'll have a legacy. I just want my legacy to be on purpose. That can be troubling. Sometimes we think about, as Steve was talking about in communion, about sometimes we think about ways we fall short, or ways that we mess up, or maybe things that Jesus would call us to that we find hard. I think about Peter in this encounter. Peter says, you know, I'll lay down my life for you. And he says, will you really? I tell you the truth, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. You'll disown me three times. Of that, Jesus says, don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back to take you to be with me. So that where I am, you can be home. In the first century, we read a number of times in the Bible about wedding feasts. And they did things a little differently than we do. There's a big feast that was called a wedding feast that's actually what we would think of as an engagement feast. Because there was a wedding feast, and then a period of months would go by where they had the actual wedding. But it was kind of a situation where there's a young man and a young woman who are there, and the young man, the bridegroom, there's the ceremony where he offers his bride-to-be a glass of wine. And she doesn't have to take it. So I'm thinking you would want to do your homework. That would be pretty awkward if she said no, but she can say no. And if she says yes, then that means it's official, it's public, we're going to get married. And then what happens from that feast, the girl goes home and begins to very intentionally learn about, in their culture, to learn about running a household and learning about the things that it takes to be a good wife. And what the young man would do was he would go back home and begin building a room onto his father's house. And they would, you know, these houses were not like we are. Most of the time we have, you know, a single family unit, but these were like, you know, generations would live together, kind of in their separate little areas, but the guy's job was to go to his father's house and build a room on, and that's what he was doing to get ready for the wedding. And he's ready for the wedding when he finishes his room, when he finishes this place that he and his new bride would live. So that's what the girl's going to do after the feast, and that's what the guy's going to do after the wedding feast. But if he offers the wine, the girl accepts it, then the bridegroom says this prepared speech. And the prepared speech would go something like this. In my father's house, there are many rooms. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to build a room for you. I'm going to build a house, and I'm going away, but I'm going to come back. When it's ready, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to take you, and we're going to go to that place so that we can be together. And I think Jesus' disciples would have known exactly what he was talking about. When he was telling them, listen, you can't go where I'm going now, but later you will go. I'm going to go away, and in my father's house there are many rooms, and I'm going to prepare a place for you, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to take you. You can count on that. Because we are connected. We are devoted. I have shown you the full extent of my love. I won't forsake you. You don't have to worry about whether I'm going to show up or not. I'm coming back. Legacy is a little bit like that. It's not something you do by accident. It's not something you dabble in. It's something you're married to. It's something that's just, it's inside you. You're devoted to it. It's what you think about. You eat, sleep, and breathe. Think about loved ones who have gone on and the legacy they left, the things that you remember, the thing that you say, okay, that person's legacy, her legacy, his legacy was this, and you know it's who they were. It's what they devoted themselves to. It's the same for all of us. These things that we do, they always flow from who we are. Doing always comes after being. Everything that we do flows from our identity. You know, I think it was challenging for the disciples to hear this for a number of reasons. But one, it's hard to imagine, you know, loving the way that Jesus loved. Can I really do that? Good news is God helps us. I mean, God is patient. It's not something we get to today. You don't get there on the first day. You just keep at it. In the game, as Doug said. We're just in the game. We're working at it.